er mennesker, og mennesker er makt. Teknologien får stadig større innflytelse over livene våre. Oslo Freedom Forum, den store menneskerettskonferansen, ble avholdt nå nylig i Oslo. Første dagen handlet om teknologi, med særlig vekt på bitcoin og blockchain, kryptovalutaer. Og jeg fikk snakke med Galia Benarzi, en ung kvinne som jobber med disse spørsmålene, som er opptatt av penger. Hva er egentlig penger? Hun har laget sin egen kryptovaluta. Jeg synes det er vanskelig å forstå disse tingene, men sammen med henne så prøvde jeg å bli litt klokere. Her er vår samtale. Vær så god. Welcome to my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I heard a lecture on the Oslo Freedom Forum about digital money and real money. Basically about the history of money and the meaning of it, philosophy behind it. It was fascinating. So tell me, what is money?
Sure. So money, like everything we see around us, is an invention that humans came up with to help us achieve a goal. In the case of money, the idea is to allow us to collaborate in a large system or at scale without necessarily knowing everyone in the system. So the money becomes a kind of a transference of trust between people who may or may not trust each other inherently and allows us to give to the system and receive from the system in a asynchronous way. What I mean by asynchronous is you can give someone something now, maybe sell them a massage or a lunch, and you can get something from the system later, maybe a house or a car. You no longer need to buy and sell at the same moment. In time, that was what we used to do, called barter. I would give you my chickens and you give me your tomatoes. And the invention of money really allowed us to separate the buying from the selling. So you can sell now, get the money, buy later with the money.
Would it be possible with the growth we have seen if it wasn't for the money?
So money is what has allowed us to grow in this way. Just as writing is what allowed us to grow in the way that we have as a species, to share information over time and space. So in the very early days, you had to be next to someone who was sharing information in order to get it from them.
The oral culture.
Right.
They were telling stories.
Exactly. And once we had writing, we could get a story or information from someone who was on the other side of the world in a different time, hundreds or thousands of years ago. And so writing really allowed us to encapsulate and compound our information sharing over time, and money in the same way allowed us to encapsulate and compound our collaboration over time. You cannot build a skyscraper without money, because you cannot bring all the people that are needed for all the different functions to make the windows, to drill the hole, to put the electricity, all at the same time to agree, okay, now we're making a building. And so the money is the mediator between all the different components that require large-scale collaboration. You can think of an iPhone in the same way. It takes thousands of people to make an iPhone. And only because we have money can we coordinate the incentives of all of those thousands of people around creating an iPhone.
You mentioned Yuval Harari in your lecture at the Oslo mm-hmm. Freedom Forum today. I also read him, and he's very fascinated with the whole his way of telling
yes.
stories. And he says that money is one of the greatest stories in humankind.
Yes, and in fact, the ability to tell stories is the distinguishing factor of humankind. Because we can tell these stories, because we can agree or disagree, because we can share information in these ways and create culture in these ways, we can collaborate at a large scale. We can also not collaborate at a large scale, right? That's also a story that we tell ourselves about us versus them, the other.
Tribal, tribes.
Enemies, scarcity, competition. These are all stories. We could just as easily tell ourselves a different story. The other is like me. We have abundance between us. The more I give, the more I get. Nothing is forever, so nothing is mine. There are a variety of stories that we can tell, and you know, the ones that have won out over time are the ones that we live with. And these are also the ones that are within our power to change.
Because it's strange. I mean, this green bill or red or whatever mm-hmm. piece of paper that you can actually, it's about trust, that you can
yes.
trust it. And he also compares with the chimpanzees or the monkeys.
Yes.
They can relate to give away a banana and
yes.
get the banana back and trade. But they cannot have the abstract way of thinking about that the bill of paper can have value.
Right. That bill of paper, whether it's a bill of paper, whether it's a digital coin, this thing that we call money essentially represents your balance of payments with the greater system. So normally we think of the system as our country, right? And the U.S. dollar, let's say, represents my balance within the U.S. economy. Your money represents your balance of payments within your country's economy. But this balance is basically an idea which says you gave to the system and now you are owed to receive from the system. And again, not from the specific node in the system that you gave to, but from some other node. And so we have a flow network where everyone is giving into the flow network and everyone can then receive from the flow network at the rate of which they gave. So we hope.
And like Karl Marx, Adam Smith, they talked about money as measuring labor, basically. That in a way, that's the transaction.
Right. Labor is one of the fundamental units that we can point to when we talk about value, because it is our time and it is our energy. There are other units that we can point to, like our wisdom, our experience, our skills, right? When you talk about your skill as a healer, you have both a labor component and also an experience component. We can point to assets like the land that you own or the shoes that you made. And here also we get into kind of very nuanced stories about what is valuable and what is ownership. So when I say the land that you own, that is a story that we told ourselves, that any individual or a specific individual can own a piece of this earth that was never ours to begin with. And so even the story of private property is a story that we tell ourselves. And like all of the stories, it can be good and it can be bad.
So governments can nationalize if
absolutely.
You have a different regime. Like
absolutely.
The communists, the Soviet Union.
In the context of the Oslo Freedom Forum and in general when we talk about human rights, private property is considered an indicator of freedom and an indicator of a healthy relationship between the government and the governed. Why? Because it means there's rule of law and it means a decision is a decision and it means that a different person cannot take away your property by virtue of being in the government or not in the government. However, if you kind of zoom out and look at private property as a story that humans tell ourselves, and this is actually from another book I love on this topic called Sacred Economics by Charles Einstein, highly recommend. He talks about private property as a very bad story that humans have told ourselves because, you know, if we look forward in time, there are many more humans coming in the future than we have now or than we've had in the past, or so we assume, if we assume that we survive as a species and continue to grow and thrive.
Hopefully.
And there is a limited amount of Earth on planet Earth. And so if everyone can own parts of the Earth and all these future people are coming, there won't be any Earth left for them to own. And of course, we pass on private property in our inheritance to our children, to our grandchildren. And so you do have an increasing concentration of private property, of pieces of the earth, to the existing holders of the property, and much, much less available to the folks or the families or the descendants of the families that don't currently own property.
They say buy land, they don't make it anymore.
Right. There is no more land being made than the land that we have. And it's a very interesting, I love to give this example because it really shows the complexity of stories and the complexity of ideas and that there is not a binary right and wrong, black or white. Private property is great when it indicates that your government is abiding by the rule of law and that people feel safe and protected. And private property is not so great when we talk about how do we devise an economic system for the present and the future of the species on this planet that is equitable for all. So, you know, I say the same about money and the same about government and the same about taxes. You know, nothing is good or bad. It's how we implement it and how we manifest it in society that can be better or worse.
I would say taxes is mostly good because it gives the population a possibility to keep the government accountable. You have the difference between two oil states, Saudi Arabia and Norway, where we pay taxes. We are a democracy. We can keep our government accountable. While in Saudi Arabia, the government gives away as a good gifts to its people, gifts which then it's not possible to have democracy. I think that taxes is a condition for a democratic society.
Yeah, and transparency is a condition for taxes.
Yes,
right. If you can count on the taxes doing what they say they're going to do with them, then that's wonderful. And if you can't, then you're living in a story that is misaligned with what actually happened. So it's a great example. But taxes really are our commitment to the collective, right? When we look at individual liberties, or when we look at drive and motivation, we all have an inherent drive and motivation around our own well-being and presumably the well-being of our family or our next of kin or of our close community. But when we take into account the reality that we coexist with people well beyond our close community, well beyond our family, taxes are our commitment to coexist. Whether it's build the road or build the bridge or build the hospital or, help people in a crisis or whatever are the collective values, taxes are our commitment to live beyond and for more than just ourselves.
And both money in itself and taxes is about trust. Mm-hmm. You were talking about digital money, the new thing, cryptocurrency. How does it work? What is it?
Yeah, so it's such a fascinating concept because it is the first time really in society and in history that we can imagine money, real, viable, usable money being created by anyone in the population. And so what I mean by that is throughout history, whether money has been physical like gold or paper like bills or even digital like the digital money that we have today, it has always been issued. Its coming to existence has come from the rulers of a country, whether those are kings or emperors or presidents or ministries of finance. And today, for the first time, and thanks to blockchain and cryptocurrencies, and I'll get into it further in a moment, thanks to these technologies, we actually are witnessing the very first mass social experiments of what it looks like when money is issued into existence from nothing to something by people that are not elected and that are not in charge formally of the society. So it's a very exciting
mind-blowing
time.
I try to get my head around it, and I think it's very, very difficult to grasp both the concept in itself and its consequences.
Sure. So as we talked about, money is essentially a technology that we use to stand in the place of trust, to say this group, whatever the group is, a country, a neighborhood, a nation, this group is working together, and this system is how we account for who's doing what. You're doing more, you're doing less. If you're doing more, you get more. It means you can take more from the system. You're doing less, you get less. Means you can take less from the system. So up until now, the guardian of these trust networks, as represented by the currencies that operate them, have been our governments. But when you say now, if we could make a reliable trust network that was not run by the government, why should we not? It's similar to saying if we can create a reliable news source that's not run by the government, like a blog or a YouTube channel, then why not, right? And today we definitely don't expect, at least in the Western world, we don't expect to only get our information from the government. We expect, in fact, to get our information from a diverse news sources. And then, of course, we have an accountability question of which news do we trust. But certainly there are options out there of which news we can consume. So some of the same principles apply to money, which is why should we rely only on our government to be the custodian of a trust network that lets us work together? We can also create trust networks that allow us to work together. And now the key with money, and the reason this hasn't happened yet in money, but it has happened in media and video and information sharing, like some of the examples I mentioned, is that money has a very, very unique property, different than information. Money can only exist in one place at one time. That is how its accounting property is maintained. So what do I mean by this? When I give you my money, I no longer have it. You have it. Only one of us can have it at one time for it to be money. If we both have it, if I give it to you and I still have it, it's not money, it's a copy, it's a fraud, it doesn't serve the function anymore that money is meant to serve of telling us where is the accounting.
You can't eat your cake and have it too.
Right, with money, absolutely. With information, it's a different story, right? If I share a document with you, I have it, now you have it, we both have it, it hasn't corrupted the document that we both have it. If I share a photo with you or a video, any kind of media, any kind of information can be classified as easily or possible to replicate without corrupting the original. And money or value can be classified as existing in only one place and time. If it exists in multiple places, it corrupts the value of the money itself. And so the reason that we have not been able to create, you know, user-generated value networks or user-generated currencies is because up until now, we've needed someone to guard the database and basically assure us that the money is only in one place at one time. This is why we have banks, right? The banks tell us, your money is in this account, my money is in this account. They can't just move it from account to account. They keep the database and they say who has what. And we trust them to say who has what. We haven't had yet a technology that has allowed us to maintain these databases in a public way and not run the risk of the money being everywhere, right? And being replicated and copied and
losing value.
And basically losing value. And blockchain technology, and this is what is so incredible about blockchain, blockchain is a network database technology that allows us for the first time in history to make sure that all the data is where it's supposed to be without anyone in the center protecting it.
So what is blockchain? Explain.
So blockchain is basically, you know, when you dig into the science and the math of it, it's a very sophisticated cryptography structure that essentially uses math to constantly verify every node in the network, meaning in a very simplified way that every piece of data is where it belongs in the spreadsheet or in the database. And what it means for us, for non-technologists, is that we can collectively guard the data. We can collectively guard the money. Not any one person needs to guard it. We don't need to trust any one person to guard it. The way that it works, again, in a simplified fashion, is that every node in the network, every computer in this network of computers is constantly double checking every other computer. And again, using sophisticated math tools, basically the way that it works is that the network will ask a very, very advanced math problem to all the nodes in the network, and the computers essentially use their computing power to run, you know, millions and millions and millions of recursions trying to solve this math problem, and the one that solves it is the one that, you know, verifies that piece of data.
It's like finding the right piece of puzzle. The
yes.
one who finds the right piece of puzzle gets the next block in the chain.
Exactly.
And then they have to compete again for the next block.
Exactly. And so what that means, what this architecture lends itself to, is that in order for someone to say, ooh, here's the piece of the puzzle and it's the wrong piece. Oh, your money's not here, it's here. Oh, I don't have this money, you have this money. In order to corrupt the system, you would need the agreement of over half of the nodes in the network. So from a bottom line perspective, it makes it very hard to manipulate a system when everyone is in control of it together. And so using this cryptography and this kind of math language between computers, we've essentially created a network architecture where everyone together guarantees that the information is true and accurate, and it is very, very hard to make changes in the database.
So one of the main thing with currency, the transparency and the liquidity is taken care of. But the other side of it that concerns me is that what really marks a nation state is the ability to print money and to that politicians to be in charge of, I mean, collecting taxes, creating welfare, redistributing welfare, the fortune in society. So this makes the politicians, I mean, they lose a very important tool in ruling a country.
Yeah, so it's fascinating what you say, and this is part of the reason that the topic is so interesting, and also that it's so sensitive.
And scary in a way.
And also frightening. So there's a couple things I would add to what you said. Certainly, dominion over the financial system of a country is one of the main pillars of the privilege and responsibility that governments have. It's not the only one, though. Another one, for example, is the dominion over the military force of a country. of course, everything relates to money, but let's call this a different category of influence, right? Is the commander-in-chief or the general-in-chief of the military is usually the president or the, you know, the leader of the country, and they get to tell the army what to do, how to do it, who to protect, how to protect them, who to not protect, you know, all the things. So there's another area, which is kind of the what we call the monopoly on violence. The monopoly over the police force, the monopoly over the National Guard and the military. And then, of course, the third thing is to facilitate the bureaucracy of running a nation, right? So this is how do the laws get made? Which laws get made? How do we enact them? How do we enforce them? All of the kind of day-to-day operations of running a country. So these are also in the domain of governments. Now, with money, it's very interesting because what this evolution in technology is causing, in addition to a lot of, you know, excitement and also fear and kind of a volatility in these new currencies, it's also really raising the question that you asked right now, which is, what should our governments be doing? And if we roll that back a moment and we ask, of the things they are doing now, what are they good at doing? If we look all around the world and we have very many models of government and different types of governments, which governments are doing well in any of these categories? Which governments are doing well facilitating the economies of their local nations, printing the right amount of money, distributing it to the right people in society so that the right economic, you know, problems are solved and the right production is created and the right international cooperation with other nations is created? You know, I'm not an expert, but I would say not many. I think Norway actually is very, very high on the spectrum of effective governance of the national economy and also the national bureaucracy. But if you look kind of everywhere else, and if you ask the citizens of most nations, I think they would say, our government's not doing a great job with that. And I think if you zoom out and also, if we're honest with ourselves, it's not the right or the left that's not doing a good job. It's everyone is not doing a good job. We've had governments on the right and on the left. We've had them up and we've had them down. We've had them in and we've had them out. And the economic boom and bust cycles seem to persist. The wealthy getting wealthier and the poor getting poorer seems to persist. The challenge of welfare in a society and accounting for the well-being of the members of society seems to be harder and harder to do. The profit horizon of, you know, commercial elements that we may not think are so good for society, be it weapons or gambling or other types of businesses, keep getting steeper. So the problems seem to persist no matter who's in charge in most of the places around the world. And so it really does ask of us to ask ourselves and to ask our governments, is this really a good activity for you to be in charge of? And we could ask ourselves this in terms of information as well. If the governments were the only ones giving us the news and the newspaper and the TV stations, would that be a good system? Many of us in the West could not even imagine going back to that system. And many in less free countries can't imagine having such a system of options and choices. And so when I look at governments in their monetary function, I say, look, I don't think this is the best job for them. I don't think they're in the best position to print the right amount of money, to distribute it fairly and equally in society. I don't think they need to be banned from doing it, but I certainly don't think they need to have the monopoly and be the only ones doing it.
So in your view, does this mean it will be a new form of capitalism?
So the word capitalism is interesting because it talks about a specific type of economic framework which puts capital in the center and believes that capital is the most efficient motivator for progress. I personally like to think that there is a post-capitalism system out there. You know, in my head, I think of it as a humanism or yoganomics or whatever is next, that does take some of the best things about capitalism. And certainly capitalism has brought us to a tremendous amount of progress and production and innovation, but now kind of balances it with some other endeavors and desires that we have for humankind. So just as a few examples, you can look at growth and you can say, do we have to always be growing? Is it necessary to always be growing? In capitalism, it is. In capitalism, if you're not growing, you're shrinking. In general, a healthy market is one that's growing. When we kind of, again, zoom out to the global economy and say, you know, are we growing at the right pace for our underlying resources, for our clean air and our clean water and the well-being of our people? I think we could say perhaps not. Perhaps in this specific way, we're growing too fast.
Sounds like a very leftist approach.
It's really, you know, I don't find myself on the right or on the left. I find myself forward, which is kind of what are the next paradigms that we can bring to the table. And as a technologist, you know, I hesitate to ever think that I or my colleagues or other projects or entities in the space that I can point to have the right answers. What we like to say is build the tools. Build the tools that let the people try and let's see what comes. Steve Jobs, who is a big hero in my part of the world where I come from in Silicon Valley, said in a commencement address at Stanford University, he said, everything around you was built by people no smarter than you. And it's a reminder, the financial system and the money system is the same. And so I don't think I have the answer. I don't think any specific person has the answer, but I think that access is the answer. If you can create tools that let people try, I know there are great ideas out there. I know that there are people out there who do have innovative ways that we can create incentives for progress while also managing climate and making sure that our incentives for progress don't outweigh our future incentives for sustainability on the planet, right? And so there are literally endless paradigms that you could imagine trying. It's really about, in our field, about data. So how can you collect kind of real information from people, from the planet, that will help us inform our choices and move from kind of an emotional framework, even right and left is an emotional framework, right? Because it says you're wrong, I'm right, you're wrong, and move past it to a more data-driven framework where we can say, you know, I once thought this, but now when I look at the numbers, I think this. And I'm also aware that in the future, when we look back at these numbers, we'll also realize that we only saw part of the picture.
If you look at the cryptocurrency systems, is it about more order or more anarchy?
So anarchy is such an interesting word because it's very misunderstood. Most people think of anarchy as like a lack of government.
Chaos.
And total chaos. But what anarchy actually means, the word is, you are not in charge of me. No one is by default or by nature in charge of anyone else. It doesn't actually mean that there is no governance. It means that governance is voluntary. It's opt-in. You can opt out of it. And that it's also changeable. And that's one of the most important things, I believe, about governance frameworks is the mechanisms by which they can be changed. Because we all know the power of the default, at least in internet culture, the power of the default is everything, right? Very few people will change the settings. And in politics and government, if things take 50 years to change in government, then the energy that's needed of the population to stick with the fight for change is often not enough to make the change, right? And so the most important thing about governance structures is that they adapt to the will and the changing ideas of the people over time. I think in crypto, again, when I look at the work of Bancor, what we're trying to do is enable anyone to create a currency. And through the liquidity, the automated liquidity that we're providing, all of these currencies have the chance to be viable. It doesn't mean that they all will be viable. It means that they can all try.
You had an experiment in Tel Aviv,
yes,
with 20,000 housewives?
Right.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so it was a beautiful project called Hearts, the Heart Market. We minted a currency called Hearts for this group of mothers in Tel Aviv. And it was a completely cashless marketplace. Mothers would join the group and earn hearts just for joining, and then more hearts for bringing other mothers into the group, and more hearts for doing, you know, anything from a long list of actions that were deemed by the organizers of the community to be positive for everyone. So things you can imagine, like babysitting or making a cake for someone's birthday or picking up someone's kid at school, a variety of things would earn you hearts, and then you could shop with these hearts amongst the mothers.
So you got it in your phone, or I mean, you had it
and you had the marketplace on your phone. And in fact, at one point, we were seeing user browsing times of 30 minutes in the app per day of these mothers. And just to give you some context from, you know, Silicon Valley data analysis, 30 minutes is, you know, the level of time that people spend in Facebook or in Instagram. It's considered a very, very high amount of usage for a mobile app. Of course, we have hundreds and hundreds of mobile apps, and we have only a certain amount of minutes in the day. And the reason for this really was that, you know, there was an urgency there to see what was available, because you had this new budget of money and there were things that you could buy for it. And, you know, those things would also get bought. And so it was a very real-time experience. And what that told us was that the desire to spend the hearts that had been earned is so great that if there are items there that you want or need, it's a perfect application. It's a perfect marketplace.
Was it wealthy mothers or?
So there were some wealthy mothers in the community that were part of the ethos of bringing the community together. But most of the mothers were actually mothers who didn't have another budget to spend from. So these are cash constrained, lower class mothers in terms of socioeconomic spend budgets. And what we realized is that if they had that money in shekels, the local currency, they would have used that. But they didn't. They didn't have any shekels available. And of course, in every country that you go, the use case is very familiar, right? Many, many, many of us do not have enough free dollars or euros or shekels or yens in our pockets to get the things that that we want, much less the things that we need. And so the experiment really taught us that when you inject a community with currency and you give a framework for the ability to trust this currency, either because it's on a blockchain so you can see it very clearly, or because the community organization is such that you know the folks that are running the community and you trust them and they create the tools and the information that let you trust the network.
Was this blockchain or was it the local community?
These were actually not blockchain-based currencies. This was, we ran this pilot in 2013. And so if today we say, you know, cryptocurrencies are still a bit early for the average person to use, in 2013, it was a non-starter. And so what we decided to do back then was build off blockchain, just regular centralized currencies, but distributed. So very many in very many communities. We ran dozens of pilots like this. And what we wanted to learn was, how do people, just regular people, interact with new currencies that are suddenly in their phone? What does it take for us to believe that the heart is money? What does it take for us to spend a heart? What does it take for us to want to earn a heart? What do we need in order to trust a heart? And at what point in the experiment do we stop using the hearts? Do we start using the hearts? So we wanted to learn about the consumer behavior and how we adapt to these new currencies in our pockets.
And what was the value altogether?
So
we saw,
in the 1 year that we operated the marketplace, almost $24 million worth of commerce between the mothers only in hearts. So we measured that because one heart, we called it one shekel. One shekel was about four, there was about four shekels to a dollar. And that was the amount of hearts transactions that we saw within the year. And this was, you know, tens of thousands of items from clothes and toys, a lot of recycling. And we got asked all the time the question, you know, why weren't they doing this before? All the moms were there. They all had these clothes and toys and they all knew each other maybe. And what prevented them before from just bartering with each other or creating this kind of commerce? And the answer is they just didn't have any money. At the end of the day, the money is the jumpstart for commerce.
As we talked about in the beginning, right? That before and after the money,
right?
This idea of this paper bill that has value.
It's literally like an electricity current that moves between the people. We like to think of or talk about money like blood in the body, right? So you have oxygen, you have organs, but the blood is the one that's taking the oxygen from organ to organ and allowing the whole unified system to work together. The heart can't work alone and the lungs can't work alone. It needs the blood to move the oxygen and the other nutrients and things between the organs so that they function. And blood has a similar purpose in society. So all the people are there, all their skills are there, all their stuff is there. But the money is literally the vehicle that moves the energy or moves the things from person to person to person in a way that we can trust.
So this experiment actually created $24 million worth of economic activity that wouldn't otherwise have happened?
Exactly. So we exactly that, and we call it economic potential. And so when I ended the presentation, I ended on a slide, which was the long tail, this phenomenon that we see in the internet, which is if you reduce the technical barriers to entry and you let everyone access the tools, like you let everyone upload a video to YouTube, or you let everyone create a blog on WordPress, or now you let everyone create a currency, what you see is orders of magnitude, 2 to 3 orders of magnitude, more volume, more activity, more engagement than when there were high barriers to entry and only the professionals were accessing the tools. And so what we say about economic potential is that if we open the doors here of currency and we let every group, like these moms are just one group in one city, in one tiny country, you can imagine that there are millions and hundreds of millions of these groups, whether they're mothers or neighbors or vegans or surfers or students or activists or companies or projects or festivals. You know, there are literally infinite networks that we can imagine between people who want to collaborate together either once or 100 times or forever. If we open the doors and let all of these networks create their own currency units and cycle resources and time and skills between the members of these networks, what we expect to see is 2 to 3 orders of magnitude of economic potential, more than what the national currencies are able to capture today.
You refer to Bernard Lyotard, is that her?
Bernard Lyotard.
Rethinking Money, a book he came with. Where he discusses how many currencies can there be in the world, in a nation, in a local community. Right. Tell me about that.
Right, absolutely. So he writes a fascinating book that I highly recommend, and he does extensive work and research on this field of community currencies. So he asked himself over the years the same question, which is, why don't we have more currencies? A currency is just an agreement between people. We have all kinds of different agreements like Uber and Facebook and all these different products that we agree to use without the government giving us permission necessarily or directing the collaboration. And so he looks at natural ecosystems in nature and maps them to what essentially monetary and economic ecosystems look like. And when he looks at natural ecosystems, whether it's the rainforest or swampland, he sees that there's a dichotomy between efficiency and sustainability. So efficiency in the world of currency maybe would be having one global currency for the whole world. If you think of language, it would be very efficient if we all spoke English, right? That's what the Americans would love to see. Or if we all spoke French or Swiss or one language, it would be very, very efficient. We would never meet anyone we couldn't communicate with. It would be very, very efficient. However, on the other side of efficiency is resilience, sustainability over time. So when you look at natural ecosystems, oftentimes in nature, many, many species can eat a certain species, or a certain species can eat many other species. Many times there are multiple water sources. There's a kind of redundancy where if there is some problem with some part of the ecosystem can continue to thrive. It will change, but it will survive.
Self-repairing in a way.
Exactly, and it will be resilient. Now, in economics, those redundancies, you know, two water sources when you could have one, two currencies when you could have one, two sources of production when you could have one, are considered inefficient. And it's true that for a while there's no crisis, it is more efficient to have one than two. However, in a crisis, having two is exactly where the resilience and the sustainability comes from. And so when we look at currencies and we say, look, of course, it's very efficient to have, you know, one main currency. Look at the dollar and how efficient it is to have the dollar be our global reserve currency for the whole world. And then we say, but look, in 2008, the dollar had a major crisis because of just something that was happening in America, you know, over risk, leveraging of the banking system, under regulation, however you want to, whatever you want to, you know, pinpoint as the cause for the crisis with the dollar. And suddenly we have a global financial crisis, right? Because there isn't redundancy in that sense. And the dollar is the one that we need. And so if it's having a problem, we all have a problem. Same with the euro. As the euro crisis hits, you have countries like Greece and Spain that have no other alternative. Imagine if in Greece, when the euro crisis was unfolding, they could turn on a local currency like a local drachma, and they could use it internally to spark commerce and activity until the problems with the euro were resolved, or they could use it to help resolve the problems with the euro by continuing to create production or continuing to feed the people and create commerce and opportunity. So the spectrum that Bernard talks about is the trade-off between efficiency and resilience or sustainability. And again, like all things, they're both good and they're both bad. And ideally, we have some kind of balance. And so his thesis is that one currency per nation is what we call a monoculture of currency. And it's very efficient and it's not very resilient. And if we go all the way to the other end of the spectrum where each person had their own currency, we might be very resilient because everyone could always kind of rely on their own central bank. But we would be very, very inefficient. Every single transaction between every single human would incur some kind of exchange rate or need to translate between one currency and the next. And so the trillion-dollar question is how many currencies do we need? And it's similar to the question of how many blogs do we need. There is no specific right answer, but when we get too many blogs, people will start to read them less and less. The profession of being a blogger will be less and less appealing. There will be less and less value created to society, so less and less people will do it. And we believe that we'll find some equilibrium at kind of the right number of blogs. And with currency, again, if you reduce the technical barrier to entry and you let anyone try, the thesis is we will find the natural equilibrium of the right number of currencies. If there are too many, people will stop using them and they'll gravitate towards the ones they're using the most often or that they're that are the most successful. And if there are too few, it's the world we find ourselves in now where there are so many people out there with so much economic potential and just not enough money units in their pocket to express their potential in society.
Do you see a different need in authoritarian and undemocratic regimes for cryptocurrency versus in free democratic societies, both when it comes to the actual need for the currency and also when it comes to the effect on the nation state and the democracy in the more democratic part of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. This is such an interesting question because it's both there are both unique things about the different types of nations that you're talking about and also something completely uniform to all of humans in all of the civilizations that we have. So the difference that I see is less between authoritarian and democratic societies. It's more on an economic level between developed and developing societies. Why? Because in the developed societies, we have a kind of banking infrastructure that does actually make the existing currency pretty easy to use. In America, we have PayPal, we have banks, we have digital banking. We, you know, it's not hard as an American to send U.S. dollars from me to you. It's actually quite easy. So the switching cost that Americans will need to, you know, feel that the new currencies are 10x more valuable to them or more useful to them is actually quite a steep curve. In the developing nations where banking infrastructure is not widely available, where it's actually very hard to take money and send it from person to person, I think there the immediate benefits of cryptocurrency are so much more tangible. Of course, also when you look at freedom and human rights, in countries under authoritarian regime, the opportunity of having free currency may be the difference between life and death.
And you can escape from your country and you can carry your fortune with you in
right,
your head.
Right, absolutely. So it's a very, very existential and palpable need. In the developed countries, the difference between free currency and what we have today, kind of the national currency, might be the difference between life and a life well lived, right? So certainly to that person, that is an existential difference. But if you look at the map, there are different opportunities to be had. I think that kind of broadly speaking, of course, existential threats to one's safety and well-being and ability to speak freely, pray freely, love freely, these are, you know, of the essence and of the moment. If we zoom out to the greater endeavor of humans on this planet, I think economic freedom is the next great challenge of our time.
Could you say that the cryptocurrency, in a way, is the next step after the microfinance, where you lended money to women, very small amounts, to make them able to create an economic independence?
Yes, I would say that it's in the same direction. It's a completely different approach. So the microfinance movement says, here's the system that we have. We need to make sure that more people, specifically women or other groups, are getting access to the system. In cryptocurrency, what we're saying is this system that we have is broken. Sure, we can try to fix it. And yes, everyone who's trying to fix it in all the ways is, you know, doing great work and more power to all of those efforts. However, the real change is in changing the system itself. A system where money comes from the top and is distributed to the bottom will never treat the bottom the way it treats the top. It never will. It's gravity. And so the cryptocurrency movement says, let's build a system that's more like a network and less like a pyramid. We're going to have all new problems to solve, right? Because the technology is always part of the solution and part of the problem. But that problem of money starting at the top and trickling to the bottom, we won't have that in this new system. We'll design it differently from day one.
I really have to think this very much over. I think it's so complicated just to get my brain around it.
Yeah, well, it's a very three-dimensional network. Right. So when you think of money the way it is today, you can almost think of it like 2D. You have governments, they print money, the people need to get the money, and then there's all the things that happen along the way. And there's finance, and there's Wall Street, and there's microcredit, and there's all the things. In this next version of money coming from everywhere in society, you really have a 3D network architecture, and any change in any node in the network is affecting the other nodes in the network. And so you do need sophisticated math and algorithms and visualization and of course, governance structure and rules of engagement to manage this kind of complex 3D network architecture. But the 3D one is living and breathing and vibrant, and I think will grow in kind of new shapes and dimensions that are very hard for us to imagine from a 2D place.
Could a national state's answer to this be to create national cryptocurrencies that will make the politicians keep their tools to rule a country and just transfer in Norwegian crowns into crypto crowns that still was ruled by the nation state?
Yes, absolutely. And I think they should do that. I think that if anyone in the street can make a cryptocurrency, then certainly the governments should be able to make a cryptocurrency as well. What will be different is that their currencies will need to compete with all the other currencies. They won't have that special privilege that today we give to governments, right? So yes, they should make cryptocurrencies, I believe, because cryptocurrencies are secure. They are efficient. They are transparent. They are immutable. They are customizable. I mean, there's so much opportunity for governments as well. What they shouldn't do is say, only my cryptocurrency is the one that we use. Anyone who uses a different cryptocurrency or other currency is going to jail, right? So that's the line, is make them, these should be available to everyone, governments included. But we need to end the monopoly of governments on currencies.
A little bit about you in the end. You started out in Silicon Valley, grew up in California. You're one of the not so many women in technology. How was it to come as a young woman into the technological world of Silicon Valley?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's so much opportunity. And I think growing up as a woman in California and in Silicon Valley and in this generation, you very much have an open door. There's no part of me or my peers that says or thinks that I can't do something because I'm a woman. I think there's very, very much opportunity and kind of the privilege of credibility. That said, you know, the workplace and in general, our society is coming off of a very, very long, you know, multi-thousand year patriarchy, and it's still with us. So I feel very blessed and privileged to be able to even stand strong in this scenario. But I would be lying if I said, you know, it's not extremely challenging the way that it must be extremely challenging for other minority groups, the way that it's challenging for the disabled, the way that it's challenging for any other, right, that's not in the in-group. I think that it goes so much beyond technology, right? Because it's in industry, it's in economics, it's in leadership, it's in politics. And I think any time that we have men and women together creating the systems, we have better systems. That is not something that I can prove with data. I'm sure that others can. It's something that I feel deep within me. And in fact, when I've been learning about Norway and the culture and the politics and the economics that you have here, my understanding is that it's actually a healthy collaboration between men and women in leadership that is attributed with also creating quite a healthy and sustainable economy that I'm sure is imperfect, but it sounds like does, you know, a far greater job than many of the other economies at meeting the needs of the people. So, you know, I think this pendulum that's easy to be on between, you know, all the men, look what you did, the women could do it this way or that way. I think really the key for humans is in the balance, which is together we can use, you know, the benefits of masculinity, the benefits of femininity, the pitfalls of both. We are both, you know, perfectly flawed, and we can collaborate, which is what we were designed truly to do, and create systems that both take into account today and tomorrow, that take into account the leaders and the ruled or the underclass, that can take into account the privileged and the disenfranchised. I think that men and women together can design the best systems for men and women to live in.
Yeah, I think the mix is good for business and good for humankind.
Yes.
Now you live in Tel Aviv, mm-hmm. in Israel.
Yep.
The startups and the innovation atmosphere in Israel, it's a vibrant community. Why is Tel Aviv such one of the most innovative societies in the world?
Yeah, it's such a good question, and people have different answers to it. I think that part of the history of the Jewish culture, really going back to biblical times, has been a culture of debate and a culture of education. It is part of the story and the narrative of the people to ask questions and debate everything. And the faith is not built on blind faith, but on kind of deep questioning, and questioning is really encouraged. Even the conversion story of joining the Jewish religion is not one of force, but one of will. And so I think historically you can point to a lot of factors that lead the nation and the people that are disciples of this nation to ask questions and kind of strive for education and research and uncovering things and innovation. I think in the short recent history, the politics of the nation have really forced the people to be innovative. So one of the consequences of having such an unfortunate conflict with your neighbors is that you're forced to build a market kind of outside of your neighborhood if you can't do business with any of your neighbors. And so I think that has really forced the industry of the country of Israel to kind of think through, okay, what can we export, you know, far away? And one of the most easily transportable exports is knowledge, knowledge and innovation and technology and
stuff in my iPhone.
Yep, the chips in your iPhone and the film on the solar panel and the irrigation system in your garden. And you know, we can point to hundreds of technologies. So I think the recent political climate also leads to this outcome. And then just culturally speaking, Israelis like to be their own boss. And so it does just even structurally lead to a lot of startups, a lot of college graduates and folks that are coming out of the military much prefer to design their own product or design their own company than to be in someone else's company. And so it leads to a proliferation of smaller initiatives and smaller research projects. I think also the mandated military service and the IDF leads to a population that is incredibly well-trained, right? So everyone comes out of their experience with some amount of technical knowledge, some amount of collaborative kind of social knowledge in terms of how to work together in a team, how to execute projects, how to get things done. So all of that together leads to a very innovative environment. And especially when your local market is so small, it really forces you to work with the world and understand what you can offer to the world, because what you can offer to your local economy is usually not very scalable.
Finally, my question to all my guests, what is going to be the story about you? Gale Benarzi was the one who...
I hope that the story is that me and my team are a part of this process that leads us to reimagining what value is in society. I think that the stories that we've told ourselves about economics and about finance and about power are stories that are leading us to less than optimal outcomes. I think that the story of sacred economics, of what it means to be a human, what it means to have a human consciousness, what it means to be a part of a society and of a fabric, I think that we can build and design economic systems that look more like that than they do like Wall Street or like banks. And so I hope that our legacy is being, you know, there are many, many teams working on these initiatives, and we look forward to collaborating with as many of them as possible. I hope that part of our legacy and part of my legacy is really changing the game for how we think about value, how we ascribe value, how we trade value, and really making value valuable again.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you to you out there for listening, and thank you to our producer, Magne Antonsen, and we will touch base again next week.